ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. So we're now partway through a series on the war in Iran. We've talked about some of the reasons Donald Trump might have wanted to get involved in this conflict at this point. And in our next few episodes, we're going to look at what his administration and the Israeli Defense Force are up against in Iran itself. On Thursday, we're going to have a look at the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and how they were formed just before the start of the Iran-Iraq War and how they used that war to become what they are today, an incredibly influential political, military and economic force. What I can't do is talk about what it's like to deal with the IRGC firsthand. Someone who can is Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert. She's an Australian academic who spent over 800 days in an Iranian prison after being falsely accused of espionage and interrogated over countless hours by the IRGC. When we spoke to her about her time in prison last year, she described some of the IRGC interrogators as, quote, complete dumbasses. With the Iranian regime under more threat than they've been in decades and the IRGC struggling to prop it up, I thought it might be a good time to find out more about these complete dumbasses. Kylie Moore-Gilbert, it is wonderful to have you back. Thanks for being here.
It's wonderful to be back. Thanks, Matt.
What has your reaction been to the extraordinary events of the last week and a bit?
Oh, my God, I think I'm still digesting them. It's still, for me, shocking that this is happening. This is a kind of a war that's been projected or threatened or warned about for well over a decade now. You know, people were talking about a regional war with oil installations being hit in the Gulf and et cetera prior to the nuclear deal of 2016 as being a possible ramification and something to be avoided at all costs. And so it's kind of wild that this has eventuated. Why now? I mean, given Trump's pronouncements in the past about foreign military intervention and not wanting to start wars, I'm just flummoxed about the fact that it's happened at all.
Has anything surprised you about how the Iranian regime has responded by sending missiles not only into Israel but into their surrounding Arab Gulf states?
The extent to which they have targeted their Gulf Arab neighbours, many of which, you know, they had been friendly with and certainly had diplomatic relations with, did surprise me. They had threatened this, of course, and everybody knew for years now that this was one possible deterrence to attacking Iran, that very important strategic area where most of the world's oil transits through would be drawn into the conflict. But they seem to have sent more missiles toward the Gulf than they have to even Israel. And I think that surprised many people, you know, attacking states that were friendly toward Iran, like Qatar, like Oman. They've also sent a few drones to Azerbaijan and a missile toward Turkey as well. So, you know, countries that had been mediating on the part of Iran and had been friendly and assisting Iran in the past. So that's, in my opinion, a bit of an own goal. I mean, Iran has very few allies and very few friends. Why would you target your friends? I think, though, also, as we saw over the weekend, Pezeshkian, the president, actually apologized to those Gulf nations for attacking them, which shows that, you know, he doesn't actually have any, I mean, we already knew this, he doesn't have any control in a material sense over the regime and its decision making, and that's largely the IRGC that's sending those missiles and rockets. And they continued to bomb Dubai Airport, for example, even after Pezeshkian's apology. So it shows you the extent to which the system is not really communicating with each other inside Iran, and the fact that most of the power actually right now lies in the hands of those IRGC and other military commanders.
We're going to be looking at the origins of the IRGC this week in our main episode on Thursday, but you've spent a lot of time with them in one-on-one situations or one-on-several situations. What did you make of them during those experiences?
I got an insight into how they responded to crises, actually, and nothing like this, obviously. The two kind of inflection points that I was around for were the 2019 mass protest movement, in which the prison facility I was being kept in, Dualif Unit of Evin Prison, which was run by the IRGC, was flooded with protesters and political prisoners and others that they had rounded up in the streets. They killed about 1,500 people in the streets during that 1 week or so. And I also saw the assassination of Soleimani in January 2020, which was also ordered by Donald Trump. And that was huge. I mean, that was probably a bigger crisis for the IRGC than the protest movement. They'd put down many a protest movement in the past. Soleimani was elevated to be almost the third personality of the Iranian regime after the two supreme leaders. And his picture, almost 24 hours after the assassination, it started appearing on the wall, you know, of many of these official buildings alongside Khomeini and Khamenei. He was a symbol, you know, he appeared everywhere in the mourning rituals and the sort of excessive state TV broadcasts and everything. It was weeks and weeks of sort of lamentation and chest beating and propaganda. And, you know, I remember I went to the IRGC's headquarters in Tehran the day before I was released. This opulent marble and gold, you know, looked like something out of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. You know, I think they have the same interior design taste. But they had this like three-story poster of Soleimani there. This was big for them as well. And they had several plots that they'd put in train to attempt to get that revenge that were thwarted. But they would have liked to have seen a high-level assassination or killing of a senior American official, I would say, to compensate for that in their mind. That Ayn al-Assad base that they struck in that kind of weird symbolic strike where they injured some personnel but didn't kill anyone, the American base in Iraq that they struck immediately after, that was sort of performative. It was similar to the strike on Qatar after the 12-day war of last year, where they telegraphed in advance, "Hey, everyone, get out of the base. We're about to send a missile your way." You know, it was the immediate reaction, but it wasn't the payback. I imagine they still had plans to avenge Soleimani, but they have they're playing a long game. They're not going to do it immediately. They had several bungled attempts at thinking about perhaps assassinating Trump or Mike Pompeo or John Bolton or some of these characters, but they never got far with them.
They were almost sort of trying to hire people on Craigslist to kill them. They were caught and foiled at the stage where they were still like putting out a bounty. It seemed quite indicative of the incompetence that you observed firsthand.
I mean, like, this is how did I come home? I was swapped for three incompetent terrorists, one of whom blew off his own legs in the process of trying to, you know, perform a terrorist attack in Thailand. So they have a long history of bungling international ops. They thought that they were like James Bond in an Iranian garb, and they were running around with sort of fantasies that they were going to take out people overseas and conduct these highly sophisticated, highly complex operations. But almost never they actually succeeded because they're, as I said, they're incompetent.
And look, there's plenty of things that can be said about the FBI, but they're capable of detecting these sorts of things through their enormous surveillance networks. But we were discussing the beginning of 2020 and the fact that you were in prison at that point. That was an interesting time to be in prison as COVID was really hammering Iran, one of the worst hit countries in 2020. What was your experience like observing this through the eyes of the IRGC? How did they respond to this in their discussions with you?
The IRGC at the beginning did not acknowledge COVID, claimed it didn't exist, that it was a conspiracy, that it was biological warfare invented by the US against China. So total sort of weird inversion there.
Sure.
And they didn't acknowledge it for months, actually. And we were seeing on TV there was a mask mandate. So the supreme leader himself would wear a COVID mask and would be trying to set an example to everyone, telling them you've got to wear a mask. IRGC wouldn't wear masks. And we would say, hey, like, we feel threatened here as prisoners. You guys are coming in and out of the prison every day without masks or any protective equipment, and you could give us COVID. And they'd scoff in our faces and say, there's no such thing as COVID. Are you an idiot? Like, you believe that nonsense? Like, but I'm like, your own state TV's, you know, telling us there's COVID. They've got such a conspiracy worldview and conspiracy mindset that any kind of crisis like this, their mentality is to revert to one of those conspiracies and not actually accept reality at face value. And I think that's what happened with COVID.
Do they believe in other conspiracy theories?
Oh, yeah. They, like, once I asked, I sat down with one of my interrogators and we were having like kind of a casual chat, because I became friendly with some of them toward the end when they weren't interrogating me anymore. And I ran through a whole list of conspiracies, sort of saying, what about this one? What do you think about this? And, you know, the moon landing. Do you think that the US actually landed on the moon? And they'd say, no way. Are you mad? Of course they didn't. The whole thing's obviously staged by Hollywood, you know. Why would you believe that? And, you know, September 11, obviously that was Israel. Like, that was an inside job by the US in Israel to attack the Muslim world. And, you know, like, they had all of these kind of nut job ideas. And I think it's a common feature of many authoritarian regimes when the information environment is so controlled by the government. You know that you're being lied to constantly in state media. Prior to social media and the internet, that was the only source of information you might even have, and you knew it was all lies. And so it kind of breeds this conspiracy mindset where you doubt every piece of information you get. And obviously the internet's just poured more fuel on the fire there. So it's not uncommon in Iran to believe in conspiracy theories, just regular people on the streets, not IRGC. But the IRGC, given that that's their mentality anyway, they just don't have the same understanding of reality that we have here, I don't think. Their worldview is just so different from ours.
You mentioned they don't have a lot of understanding of the outside world. Do you get the impression that they have travelled, that they've seen much of the world?
Oh, gosh, look, like, most of them can't travel. They're not actually allowed to travel. They're monitored and surveilled themselves, many IRGC members, and they're viewed with suspicion by their own organization, which is constantly, because of the conspiracies, on the lookout for people who've flipped or people who are informing for the enemy. And we know there are a lot of them, because the intelligence that Israel and the US has been privy to shows that they've penetrated these organizations to a very high level. So they're very paranoid about that, and they see traveling abroad or having any links to foreigners at all as being highly suspect. But the higher level ones, on the other hand, would brag about having multiple passports in multiple names. You know, God knows how many names they have, pseudonyms, aliases, but they can just print Iranian passports in whatever name they want. So you need permission from very high up in the organization to go overseas at all. And I think you need an exit permit from the regime as well. They'd ask me toward the end of my incarceration, what are you going to do when you get out of here? Like, you're going to be freed one day soon. We're negotiating with your government. What are you going to do? And I was like, oh, I really want to just head to Thailand for a few weeks and sit on the beach and do nothing. And for some reason, I was dreaming of Thailand and getting a shack somewhere and just like soaking up the sun and whatever. Obviously, COVID derailed all of those plans.
Yeah.
But these guys, you know, they were like, they would say, oh, we've been to Thailand. We go to Thailand all the time. And I'd be sort of like, sure you do. And yeah, one of them would say, oh, I went to Pad Thai Beach in Thailand. Like, oh, what's that? You know, turned out he meant Pattaya Beach. And I was like, it's Pad Thai's a food, dude. It's not a beach. And we had a whole argument over whether Pad Thai was the name of a beach in Thailand. So that kind of shows you their international awareness.
Pad Thai Beach. I feel like I've eaten there.
Oh, honestly, like, but that it's that mentality where they will not, it's that male ego thing, especially like, you know, Islamist, fanatical Islamist religious guy has quite a misogynistic view of the world. As a woman, I'm telling him it's not Pad Thai Beach. Would not accept that. He knows best. He knows more than I do. It's Pad Thai Beach.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, the guys who got swapped for me, the three bungling terrorists who were arrested in Thailand, I mean, I think it was probably the first time they'd left the country, and there's actually social media pictures of them out partying in nightclubs the night before their attempted terrorist attack, mm-hmm. partying with young Thai women, scantily clad, drinking alcohol, even though they're, you know, that's not their part of their ideology, with these women sitting on their laps. And then the next day they've tried to commit a terrorist attack with bombs. So I think they're just young men gone wild in Thailand, and that's the first time they've left the country, and they might never get a chance to leave again. So let's party it up, you know, before we blow off our own legs. This is, you know, I kind of feel for them in a way. Like, they live in a very, very restrictive environment normally.
Last time you were on, we talked about the hypothetical of Ayatollah Khamenei dying or being assassinated. And the fact that he hadn't explicitly named a successor, that there may be a succession issue. His son has now been officially named as the new supreme leader of Iran. Have they solved that problem by just bringing back a dynasty?
Well, this is the hypocrisy and the contradiction at the heart of Mustafa taking over, is that both Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and Mustafa's father, Khamenei, railed against the idea of hereditary monarchy. You can't have hereditary succession. You know, that's also against the principles of Islam and Sharia. The Islamic Republic was set up initially under Khomeini for the most storied, most well-regarded senior cleric or ayatollah in the regime to lead the country. And they had to water that down a little bit. When
it was a meritocracy to a certain extent, you know. I mean, this guy was really the most senior guy and he took over.
You know? With the most followers, most religious followers, called Marja Taqlid. And they had to water that down when Khamenei took over, because he hadn't achieved that really, really high rank. He wasn't even an ayatollah. They had to fast track that when he was named the preferred successor. And so, you know, they've kind of got rid of that meritocratic aspect, or at least, you know, it's only within the very narrow confines of who's ideologically aligned with the regime and who's on board 100% and then who has clerical attainment. And Mujtaba, you know, he also went to the seminary and is a cleric as well, but he's a very junior cleric. And I think he was fast-tracked to ayatollah status as well a couple of years ago when he became in the running for potentially being a successor. They fast-tracked him. But everybody, you know, nobody really follows him. But at the same time, it's continuity. And in a time of war, they've got another Khamenei in charge, someone who has been operating behind the scenes in the system politically for years now and is considered hardline, a continuation of his father's rule. But yeah, I mean, he's, if you look at the Iranian constitution and how it describes who the supreme leader should be, he does not fit the bill at all.
I mean, I suppose there's possibly a bit of a who would want that job situation at the moment. In last week's episode, we talked about how Donald Trump has kind of got into the habit of these lightning quick military interventions, killing Soleimani or grabbing Maduro out of his bed. Already we're talking about this theoretical 4-week war being an 8-week war, or maybe it'll be going in September or something like that. What is it about Iran that has broken the spell that Donald Trump thought that he had over his ability to achieve military objectives very quickly?
I'm struggling to understand why Trump made the decision he made. I think Netanyahu has been in his ear about this for years now. But Trump, you know, pushed back many, many times before against the idea of a mass bombing campaign or regime change in Iran. I think Trump was just, you know, high on the success of Venezuela, which, you know, in retrospect, it looks like it was an easy thing. But at the time, it absolutely was not. And it could have gone awry very easily. And all kinds of risks were present in that operation. I mean, going into a foreign country and kidnapping essentially the leader and the dictator of that country. I mean, all kinds of things can go wrong there. I think he underestimated the difficulty of doing a similar thing in Iran and underestimated the Iranian regime, which is not the Venezuelan regime at the end of the day. The ideological stuff is just not there in Venezuela, certainly not anymore. It's more about money in Venezuela. And the Iranian regime's also made a ton of money off, you know, corrupt dealings, selling oil on the black market, sanctions busting and everything. But the ideology, especially in the upper echelons and the supreme leader and, you know, the heads of the IRGC and these kinds of people, it's what's calling the shots. It's their ideological worldview. It's not just, I want to make a quick buck off whatever business opportunity comes up. And if that means making a deal with the US on oil, I'll do it. You know, they don't think like that. So he definitely underestimated the situation in Iran, which is crazy because people have been telling him this for years. He has advisors for a good reason, though we know he doesn't listen to them.
So far, the Australian government seems to be just hoping they don't get any phone calls from the US. They've got phone calls from the Gulf states, apparently, asking for some assistance with that. There's some suggestion that we might try and be part of some sort of an international group to ensure traffic can get through the Strait of Hormuz. What would you do if you were advising the Australian government now, Kylie?
I would advise them to help our Gulf allies because they remember loyalty in this part of the world is everything. And if you look at the history of why all of these bases got set up in the first place and you look at the British exit from the Gulf and its replacement by the United States in the 70s or 60s in some states there, you can see that they value long-term loyalty and that they reward that. And so, you know, I think it would be prudent for us and rational and logical as well to assist them. That doesn't mean fighting for them and putting boots on the ground in Iran or anything like that, but they probably want assistance with missile defense and potentially, escorting tankers through the Straits of Hormuz. I imagine this is the time to demonstrate friendship with this important strategic part of the world that has unjustifiably come under attack through no fault of its own, not having done anything. And the cost for us longer term, if we say no to that request, I think, you know, diplomatically speaking and economically speaking, it's not really worth paying. I think we should probably do it.
Speaking of friends, just finally, have you heard from any contacts in Iran, what they're experiencing?
I've been trying to reach out to my friends in Iran. I've heard from one friend from prison. She just sent me a one-line message saying, we're okay, we're safe. And it took her about a week to get that message out. Another one of my friends is in prison. She was arrested in the January protests. And I know she's in Kachui prison in Karaj. Her name is Suhaila Hijab. I've heard that she's been beaten in prison and threatened with the death penalty. And this is coming from her lawyer who's got word out to another activist on the outside who passed it on to me. So I'm really concerned about her, but I know she's tough and she's been in prison many times before, so she should be able to handle it. But some other friends that I've tried to reach out to, I haven't heard anything back from. I just hope they're safe.
Yes. Kylie, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today. It's a scary and strange and terrifying and extraordinary time to be alive, really, but also to be observing this particular part of the world. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, so happy to come on again. Thanks for having me.
Kylie Moore-Gilbert's memoir is The Uncaged Sky, My 804 Days in an Iranian Prison. On Thursday, we'll be looking at how the IRGC became so entrenched in the Islamic Republic system. It's a fascinating story, not only about power, but about history itself and who gets to write it. I'll catch you then.